It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 463. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. And you could send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. But I really need to set up a separate Mike Tech Show page that everybody could then just like. I'm working on that. I will let you know when that's done. You can also check out the wiki at mtswiki.com. There you will find links to all of the past shows, links to the show notes and the audio. That is a great resource, and that's mtswiki.com. So I have the three voicemails that are follow-ups to topics that I've talked about the last couple weeks. I have some emails that are in response to those shows. So this is like a recap and a listener response to the past few shows. I want to make sure that I'm sharing all those great opinions and ideas with everybody. This is like an accumulation of that. So before we get started, you've heard me talk about Instant House Call, and you know how much I love it for remote support. Now Instant House Call has added that killer new feature that you won't find in any other remote tool on the planet. And that is the automatic PC repair, which is Foolish IT's Remote D7 utility. That's an incredible utility for you to be able to launch and repair all problems on a remote computer. Instant House Call's Auto PC Repair, it lets you fix anyone's computer no matter where you're at in the world. And it has over 100 built-in fixes for removing malware, fixing Windows, you name it. So you can start providing remote support with Auto PC Repair to your customers today with Instant House Call. My listeners can try it free for 15 days. Use the promo code MikeTechShow. So click on the link on the website or go to instanthousecall.com and download the free trial and get started with playing with that. After you try it, you will absolutely be back to make your purchase at instanthousecall.com. First off is a response to the encrypting emails.
Hey Mike, Paul from San Antonio here. It's been a while since I've called into the show, but the topic of encryption has been a focus of a few of your last episodes, and I felt that I just had to give my 2 cents on the subject. You mentioned that you were implementing a service called Smarsh to fulfill the compliance requirements of one of your clients in regard to email encryption. I personally prefer to stick to the idea of encrypting individual files and sending them as attachments. There are two reasons for this preference. For one, if you have that data that is so important or confidential enough to seek a means of encrypted distribution to a trusted source, why on earth would you even consider transferring it to a third party and entrusting them to perform the encryption for you? Even if that third party is considered a trusted source, there is always that old adage that says there is only one way to keep a secret between three people. Well, you know the rest. All jokes aside, the second reason against such a service is the human error factor. I can't tell you how many times I've received email messages with spelling errors in the message body, a missing subject line, or even a reference to an attachment that isn't there. Users tend to forget mundane tasks like running a spell check, filling in a subject line, and attaching the intended file before clicking the send button. With that in mind, I don't think I could trust my client's users to remember to type in the words encrypt or secret at the beginning of their subject line in order to command Smarsh to apply the encryption as you described. In my mind, it is less likely that a user who intends to send encrypted data to forget to encrypt the file via a utility like XCrypt, then sends it as an attachment, than it is to forget to add that one keyword to their subject line when clicking send. I believe Smarsh is an accident waiting to happen, where a user forgetting to include that keyword ends up sending confidential information in an encrypted format and subjecting his or her employer to scrutiny. XCrypt is a quick and easy encryption utility that also includes a portable version as well. I believe they have it on portableapps.com. You can encrypt individual files and assign a password to decrypt them. You can even create self-executable files so the recipients don't have to have XCrypt installed to decrypt and access the file. To me, it's the simplest error-free way of accomplishing the same task. I know you also mentioned using a compression utility like 7-Zip to encrypt and add a password to files. Unfortunately, I've seen that those are very easy to hack into compared to an actual encryption program like XCrypt. The zip files are basically password protected. I don't really consider them encrypted, even though they do some scrambling of the data. With that said, there was a recent episode of Hack 5 that featured a Chrome extension and Firefox plugin you could use to encrypt email between Gmail users. The downside is that both the sender and recipient would have to be using Gmail and this add-on, but it's still worth keeping in mind. You can keep the episode, or you can find the episode, at bit.ly/HAK51410. That's Hack 5, episode 1410.
Paul, thank you so much for that response. And I have another voicemail from Paul that I'm going to play on another topic. Here's the thing. The recipient of the email is going to have XCrypt. Now you got to educate every recipient that you're sending mail to. They're sending messages to hundreds of people all day long, and to expect a 79-year-old lady who they're managing their portfolio for, and expect that lady to download XCrypt and then follow instructions to unencrypt an attachment because it's a PDF that they need to see? Very difficult. Where going through Smarsh, they're just going to get a link, and then they're going to follow the instructions, and they'll be able to open it right up. It's a kind of a catch-22 here. I understand, and I agree with you, it's going to be difficult for all the users, the employees, to be educated, but they have been taught and trained, and they need to know that if they don't type that word, well, the penalty could be that they're fired, you know? So they have to be mature adults to understand that the condition for employment is to follow the instructions for sending an encrypted message. But I do understand, yes, a message could get through. Now, here's another thing that I didn't really tell everybody, but the broker-dealer for my client insisted upon them using this method. So there was no choice. We really didn't have any choice in selecting that service. In order for them to be compliant with their broker-dealer, they had no choice. I've been looking at that service to recommend to possible other clients, and the reason is because it is so easy to send it. Yes, you are putting your eggs in a third party's basket to trust them, but it's a company that works with the financial industry, and they are compliant. And the risk of them having an issue of something happening where they don't follow through with their SLA and providing that encryption service, what are you going to do? Here's the other problem. How do you get encrypted attachments to an end user, to a client, to make it easy on them? Now, the one recommendation you made, Paul, is to make it a self-extracting file that you then enter, and you can enter the encrypted password and it unencrypt. The problem is You can't send EXEs anymore. I mean, I've even had a trouble sending a company a .zip file. It's getting harder and harder to be able to send legitimate files within legitimate extensions, but because of the malware or because of the filtering, you have to block those extensions because they are potential threats. This is a tough one, but I really like your recommendation of AxeCrypt. That's a great program. I'm going to disagree again with Paul's response to this, but it's good info. Give a listen.
Hey, Mike, this is Paul in San Antonio again. Just to continue on the topic of encryption, I wanted to talk about TrueCrypt real quick. I, too, endorse its use to encrypt files on your hard drive, especially for notebooks, but I personally prefer utilizing its ability to create an encrypted container rather than encrypting the entire hard drive. This allows you to more easily retain encryption on files constantly accessed while still making it possible to recover from a corrupt or failing hard drive, as I've done many times in the past. Alternatively, you could partition the internal hard drive into two separate partitions and install the OS on the one partition while leaving the other for your data. Then you can use TrueCrypt to encrypt that entire partition. In the event of a corrupted or failing hard drive, you might still be able to recover the OS from its boot partition, then possibly retain the access to the encrypted data on the other partition. Even if you can't retain all of the encrypted information, at least you're not also stuck with the task of a complete reinstall of the OS on a new hard drive. You could also purchase a sizable external hard drive and encrypt it with TrueCrypt while leaving the internal hard drive unencrypted. This way, you have an encrypted drive to store all that private information on, but can also retain a recoverable OS on the notebook itself. Either way, I strongly recommend including a pass file as a two-factor authentication method for your TrueCrypt volume. Regardless of which encryption method you use with TrueCrypt, the pass file could be placed on a thumb drive and would be required to be present in addition to providing your decryption password to access your protected files. Of course, no matter what encryption method you choose, a reliable backup solution is even more important than ever before when using encryption. Backup should be kept in secure locations so that it can always be recovered by you should you lose or damage your portable and encrypted copies. Pass files can also be backed up to an additional location for safekeeping. That's all I have to say on the subject. And again, this is Paul from San Antonio. Love the show, Mike. I've gotten a little bit behind in keeping up with your episodes, but I noticed the last couple you were talking about encryption, and I just felt that I had to chime in on that. Keep up the good work, and talk to you next time. Thanks.
Paul, thank you. You have great information about TrueCrypt, and I agree with you that a container is easier to maintain, and you have better access in case something goes wrong to be able to repair the system. Well, in the financial industry for FINRA compliance, we don't want to make it easy to recover. We got to protect the entire hard drive. You have other files other than the container that must be protected. What about their email client? What about any kind of cache that happened with or cookies that happened with their website using their browsers? What about the page file that contains information? For the financial industry, you have to have a whole hard drive encrypted. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We don't have the luxury, or at least for that group of clients, I don't have the luxury of allowing just a container or just an external drive. We have to encrypt the entire hard drive for protection. So this way, if that system falls in the wrong hands, no problem. Nobody is getting in there. With my one client that we're talking about, they use that YubiKey with a 64-character password that when they press their thumb on it, it enters it in order to get into the drive just for the operating system to boot. Nobody is getting their data from any of their laptops or desktops. And that's the way it's made. But for your typical user at home, absolutely, or a client that doesn't need that level of security, I agree making it easier with a container and encrypting that container and dropping files in it. Absolutely. Now, TrueCrypt does walk you through building a recovery CD if you have any problems. Now, knock wood, I have not had any issues with TrueCrypt encryption that I had to back out of or that I had to use that CD. But for a whole section of other clients that are compelled to use semantic endpoint protection and the semantic encryption, guess what? We often have problems where done, can't get to it, can't unencrypt the drive, can't fix it. That's why backups are so important. None of those financial advisors are allowed to put as their only source data on that drive for their laptop or desktop, because the chances are actually very great on that encryption failing. I've seen too many problems with semantics encryption than I haven't seen any with TrueCrypt. I like TrueCrypt a lot and use that. I like that over BitLocker. There's lots of other alternatives out there. But I guess what you can take away from the encryption discussion here is AxeCrypt. Look into that. I did not realize there's a portable version. I am absolutely checking that out. I've used AxeCrypt to just encrypt, you know, one-off files. So great, great program. So glad you brought that up. Secondly, TrueCrypt, you know we love that. And I'm actually very happy now with a couple weeks running with the Smarsh service with my client. For clients that need that level of providing a portal for their customers, it's a good solution. I think there's a lot of solutions here that fit different markets based on their compliance and their needs, and that's what's so great about this. So, Paul, thank you very much for following up and sharing your insight to these encryption methods. Okay, now for some emails, and this is a follow-up to the BitTorrent sync testing, and this is from Brandon. I've been testing BitSync for the last month. I've synced a folder among all of the following operating systems: Windows 7, OS X 10.6, and a client Ubuntu virtual machine, OS X 10.8, Ubuntu 12.04, and Ubuntu 12.04 server. Some machines are on an enterprise network and others on a home network. The Windows and Mac apps are incredibly friendly. The Linux version needs some command line expertise. So the areas of testing were as follows: an intranetwork, an inner network, local machine, virtual machine, and inner OS. Intranetwork. Sync works fantastic inside an enterprise home network, allowing for BitTorrent traffic. Create possibilities inside an enterprise. Inner network. Sync is prone to misbehavior the more networks you make it cross. I found the sync would not always occur. Specifically, trying to sync to data to the home network machines when the data most recently updated is inside the enterprise network. Given the scenario for syncing from an enterprise to a home network is inherently prone to issues, as network security can shape and even squash the sync process. I did not test from a home network to an open public network, as I assume there would be no issues with that. For local, BitSync worked great to sync folders on a local host to a virtual machine on the same system. For the inner OS, the Windows and Mac apps are fantastic, very simple, GUI-based. The Linux version has a limited web interface with a detailed JSON config file. Best practice, the best use I've found so far, is to put BitTorrent Sync on my server, which is Ubuntu 12.04 server, used to home cloud server. This is because the nature of a peer-to-peer sync is best utilized by one, an always-on machine, and two, multiple machines. The odds of missync data increases when you limit the number of machines, the lowest is 2, and allow for them to be powered off. By having BitSync running on my server whenever I access. Other issues, I totally blew up my sync at one point. I deleted the stuff I needed, but BitTorrent Sync has a hidden trash file in the synced folder. Well, that's good. I was always able to recover my files from there. To avoid this, when BitSync isn't working right, 1, slow down, 2, disable syncing, 3, remove the data in the synced folder, and 4, re-enable syncing. That should be the only troubleshooting you need. The mobile Android version looked pretty ugly. I was hit with an error upon install and haven't had the time to mess with it. It needs root to even work, so some level of Android know-how is assumed necessary. I assume the Linux and Android versions are for those more inclined to geekiness. Hope this helps someone. And this is Running Man, who is Brandon. Brandon, thank you so much for your detailed review and analysis of running BitSync in all the different across all the different platforms that you discussed. That's awesome. Thank you very, very much. This is from Craig, and this is a follow-up to Bonjour. I missed your live show on June 13th, but I caught the video later that night. Thank you for taking the time to read my email on the show. I had forgotten to mention that Bonjour was installed because they had added iTunes and QuickTime. I think Bonjour is installed unless you explicitly untick the box for that product, though I could be wrong. I do agree that it is a useful product, but if a user wants to remove it, network settings should not be crippled. I would like to say that my client has not had a problem since my repairs, which is always good to know. And hopefully my client will purchase a router so the future things like this can be avoided. One final thing, I mentioned to my client that when installing software, go slow and read everything to make sure you are not installing programs that you don't need. This is especially true with free software. Have a great week, Mike, and keep up the great shows. And this is Craig. Thank you so much. And this was a follow-up to his email where he was trying to rip out Bonjour protocol off a client's machine, and it was so entrenched to the other networking protocols that it caused him a lot of heartache and had to do a whole lot of work in order to get the regular TCP/IP stack and everything working properly when all he was trying to do was remove Bonjour. He's right. Apple should make it easier to be able to remove it. Then, it's real easy to install, difficult to get rid of. Thanks for your follow-up and a great lesson there. And the message for everybody, even if it's not free software, but what if it's like your Adobe Flash or Adobe Reader? Take the time, pick custom on every install, and look and read what are they trying to install. Lots of times they'll say, hey, would you like to make this as your start homepage, change your homepage? And a lot of people just click next, 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 and they do it. Well, I don't want my homepage changed. I don't want this, smart search installed or something else or some other junk or added another antivirus like this McAfee that always gets shoved down our throats from Adobe. Take the time, pick custom, look for all the options. This is from David, and this is the topic combo fix. Just a quick note. On show 462, you said there was a possibility that the website combofix.org was not the official website and that it might cause a user to download a malicious file. A lot of people don't know it, but combofix.org actually is the official site. It has an advertisement, which is the only direct source of income from CombiFix for the author of the program, other than contributions. But once you find the correct link on the page to download CombiFix, it directs the user to the correct page at bleepingcomputer.com, which is a third-party host for the file and for documentation for the program. Unfortunately, the registrant of the combofix.org domain is hiding his contact information with a private registration, a practice that we may find out later this year is illegal. And that gives some people reason to doubt the authenticity of the domain. But combofix.org is legit. Thanks for another great show. I particularly appreciated your mention of tree size for examining disk space usage. I've been looking for a good replacement for my current tool, which is no longer in production. And Tree Size Portable is just what I needed. Anyway, thank you again for what you do. I always learn something from your show, and I enjoy listening to you very much. David, thank you very much. This is from Udo from Germany. Podcasting new tools for WordPress, etc. Hi, Mike. Thanks again for all your shows. For a long time, I was only a listener. I started my own little podcast a few weeks ago. It is a German podcast about television, video technology, and table tennis. I don't know if you have many German listeners or people who learn the language, but if you like, you can share the link. I am going to put it in the show notes. I can't remember everything, but I actually had German in high school for 3 years. Just thought I'd mention that. So I know a little German. I use some tools to produce the show I'd like to share. After a lot of testing, I came to the same microphone decision like you, the Shure SM58 with a pop remover. That's the filter. You see sometimes the pop filter. I use a small USB mixer, the PV6 USB from PV as an audio interface. For recording and editing, I use Reaper. Reaper is cheap digital audio workstation and worth a look for people who need more than Audacity. It's very powerful, and you can test it for 60 days, which I think is very fair. After recording, I upload the final version to Ophonic, and Ophonic optimizes the levels and normalizes the overall loudness so that every podcast has the same loudness. I enter all the metadata on their website, like title, summary, license, cover image, chapter marks, and file from a Reaper import. Ophonic then encodes the needed files and sends them to different locations, to my website via FTP, to YouTube, to archive.org, and to my Dropbox. They support a lot of different services. You can produce many audio formats like MP3, MP4, ASC, Opus, in different bit rates, and mono or stereo. I use WordPress with a new adding called Podlove Publisher. By the way, all these links are going to be in the show notes. This add-on brings a nice player and a lot of features, reducing the work to publish the show to a minimum. It takes all the metadata from the Ophonic and puts them in the right place. The add-on can create torrent files via the BitLove project. It is a little tricky to configure, but when everything is set up correctly, it's just awesome. The Podlove team is very productive. I think there is also a migration tool for PodPress and other old-school add-ons. Thanks again for your great work. Have a nice day. And this is Udo from Germany. Thank you very much for that. And again, all his podcast and all the tools that he uses to produce it, I'm going to have links in the show notes. This is from Josh, and it's migrating email to Office 365 for a school system. Hi, Mike. Got a question for you. The school system I work for has chosen to go with Office 365 for email, moving from another webmail provider. The problem is that we don't have many users using Outlook, and the current provider doesn't have or provide IMAP services. What would be the best approach and plan of attack for migrating all teachers and staff over to 365. We know that they will have to be cut off. They'll have to have a cutoff date in there somewhere when we actually change the MX records and make the Office 365 domain live instead of just being the current demo domain. Thanks for any advice you can give us on this end to relieve any of my headaches, since this is a big project. Thanks, Josh. You should really, and I hate to self-promote like this, but you should contact me at mike@mhsconsulting.net, and I'm going to follow up with you with all my contact info to contact me outside of the Mike Tech Show arena so I can give you advice. I've done very large mail migrations. Where's their email being hosted now? And what access do we have to bring the mail down? Is everybody using Outlook, for example, as a client, or are they just using the web? Because we may need to quickly use a client to bring all the mail down. I'm going to give you an example, and I'm going to answer some of these questions. Let's say that they all use the web, and they don't have any email client. Well, you could have them use the free client Thunderbird and grab all their email via POP, have it all in a local file, and from there, we could convert it and upload it to Office 365. Or you get everybody with Outlook right now, download all their mail, put it to a PST file. Once all of that is done, then you could just easily sync up Outlook to Office 365 for getting their mail and have a weekend cutover where to change the MX records. You need to put a detailed project plan together, organizing all of the steps and in what order. Maybe you start with that, then send me to just let me give it a once over for recommendations and to get the steps into the right order. It's very critical to not lose mail and make sure that, A, do you have access to change their DNS? It sounds like you do. So this way you would be able to control that MX change. What email provider do they currently have? What clients are they using? Is everybody using the same client? Is everybody using the same browser? Or is it a hodgepodge with different teachers using different ways and methods of getting their mail? Don't forget about mobile devices and how that's going to be impacted and the changes that have to occur with all their iPhones and iPads. So this needs to be thought out in detail. You're right. It is a big project. And the key to the successful project is putting a project plan together that's solid and beating it up and reviewing it, and then test your process on yourself, or pick, you know, one teacher as a pilot, you know, pilot group, a couple people. Do that testing. Make sure it's flawless. Make changes as necessary to the project plan, and then start executing that. Last email from Bill. SysInternals. I have not talked about this in a while, and I love the whole suite of utilities. Have you ever touched on SysInternals for admin utilities? You know, a couple years ago, I think I did, and I covered a lot of the utilities a long time ago, but I haven't mentioned them recently. I just learned about it, and one utility in particular called BG Info, which when run displays environmental info right on the desktop. It can be set to automatically run at startup, and I find it comes in very handy when remote accessing different computers to help keep track of where you are. There are many other useful utilities at the website, and we have this right here. I'll keep it in the show notes from Microsoft's TechNet website. Great job with the tech shows and tech vets. Regards, Bill from Nashville. Thank you very much. The programs that are included, oh, they're tremendous for analyzing your domain, your Active Directory tools. There are Process Explorer, which I love for detailed analysis. Now, that big info, that BG info, I know a lot of companies and a lot of techs that use that for all of their servers. So when you're remoting in, you got all that information right there on the desktop that you that tells you everything about that server. If you shop from Amazon.com or you know anyone that uses Amazon.com, remember to use my link, which is Amazon.MikeNation.net. There, your price is the same, but a commission comes back to help support the Mike Tech Show, and I really appreciate your continued use of that link. I thank you so much. So that's Amazon.MikeNation.net. I have some music here. Yesterday, and we're going to get away from tech here for a second, James Gandolfini passed away at only 51, and that was shocking news. And I love The Sopranos, the show on HBO. Never missed an episode. Tremendous show. And it was lots of rich music, old music, current music that was played throughout the series. And there was lots of classic songs, whether it be from Journey or Frank Sinatra or somebody, that would play at the end of an episode as the credits would roll. Well, I started looking at the top five songs that were kind of voted on through the series, through The Sopranos. And before the show tonight, I was playing all but one. And I'm going to play this Van Morrison song, which was prominent at the end of one episode. Give a listen, and then I'll be back to wrap up.
And they'll lay you down low and easy, and the lips that you kiss will say Christmas. Hear the mass that you travel the distance. You believe no lies. Try your eyes and realize Christ. La 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 la. In the business we'll shake hands and talk in numbers. Yeah, the princess will wake up from her slumber. And all the knights will step forth with their armbands. And every stranger you meet in the street will make demands. So believe no lies and try your eyes. Taking any chances, but meet them halfway with love, peace, and persuasion, and expect them to rise for the occasion. And it gratifies when you see it materialize right in front of your eyes. From New York. Okay.
That was Van Morrison and the song Glad Tidings, and I'll have a link to Amazon where you can purchase that song. I want to thank everybody for downloading and staying subscribed. I really appreciate your support. Thank you so much. And we'll be back same time, same channel next week. Everybody have a great weekend, a great week, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.